You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of September 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Tom Burgess Watson. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, a Colombian drugs kingpin in custody. The man they call Crazy Barrera is arrested in Venezuela. Journalist and author Tom Feiling helps us put this arrest in perspective. And we hear from serial entrepreneur Simon Woodruff about how he's quite literally reinvented the home.
What I always do is start with a blank sheet of paper. My blank sheet of paper was, what would a home be if it was called Yo? And I've used the sort of mechanics of stage scenery to build a 800 square foot home.
Plus, we'll be joined here in the studio by Martin Roth, who's the director of London's Victoria and Albert Museum. That's for insight into the London Design Festival. And we head to Turin, where we get the lowdown on the Pre-Italia. And we also get the latest from the Zurich Film Festival from its artistic director. All that in the next hour here on Midori House. So, a jam-packed hour here on Midori House. But first of all, let's get a wrap of the world news with Jonathan Wheatley.
The Arab League Secretary General Nabil El Arabi has said today that both the League and the United Nations Security Council were incapable of solving the crisis in Syria. Speaking at a news conference at the Arab League headquarters in Cairo, El Arabi said the League and the international community had failed Syrians, and that was shameful.
I would not say that the world has lost interest. That's, the whole world does not know exactly what to do. That's all. And this is shameful. Definitely, it's shameful. Because people are dying every day.
South African police fired tear gas to disperse protesters near a mine run by top platinum producer Anglo American Platinum today, the first sign of unrest spreading after strikers at the smaller rival Lonmin won big pay rises. Within hours of Lonmin agreeing to a pay increase of up to 22%, workers at neighbouring mines were calling for similar hikes, suggesting more trouble in store after 6 weeks of industrial action that has claimed 45 lives and threatened Africa's biggest economy. As widespread protests against a defamatory video of the Prophet Muhammad continue across Pakistan, its government has today announced that on Friday the majority Muslim country will observe a day of reverence for the Prophet. The short film, produced in California and posted online, has sparked days of violent protests. American and European embassies and businesses have been attacked in at least 20 countries. The Prime Minister, Raja Pervez Ashraf, called on his countrymen to protest peacefully.
I call upon the people of Pakistan to register their protest peacefully, but to observe restraints and not to damage their own property. I intend that a message should go to the world that the Federal Cabinet of Pakistan strongly condemns this sacrilegious film which has created unrest amongst the Muslims.
The Burmese democracy activist Aung San Suu Kyi has today met with US Senate leaders on Capitol Hill in Washington. Suu Kyi, who won the 1991 Nobel Peace Prize for championing democracy in opposition to a military junta that held her under house arrest for years, will meet privately with President Barack Obama later this evening. She said that the United States must remain aware of the difficulties in Burma.
I would like the United States to be aware of our problems. It is only by keeping up an awareness of our problems that we shall be able to establish a strong, healthy relationship between our two countries. I want our countries to be friends. You have been our friends, the friends of the forces of democracy, through long years.
The United States has just hours ago removed sanctions that generally barred American companies from dealing with Burma's President Thein Sein and the Speaker of its Parliament. And finally, staying in the United States, a judge who sentenced a man to 4 years in prison for firearms charges performed a marriage ceremony minutes later to wed the new inmate and his long-term girlfriend. Larry Austin shared a very, very brief kiss with his bride, Dusty Trojak, before officials whisked him off to prison in Oklahoma City. And those really are the stories at the top of the hour on Monocle 24.
Thank you. Jonathan, that was a very romantic note to end on there.
A brief encounter, I think.
Yes, very exciting. So they got married.
Very, very briefly, yes. Mm. But he's in jail now for 4 years. So I don't think he'll see his new wife now for till the end of the term.
Well, I was going to say only
in America, but I suppose this sort of story could happen in England, could it? I suppose it could.
I don't know. I don't live.
Or in France?
Absolutely. Everything happens in France.
Okay.
Everything's possible.
Excellent.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Dobro pozdravljat. Monocle 24.
Essa é a Monocle 24.
Monocle 24. This
is Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Det här är Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is indeed Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One in London. Now, we're going to begin in Venezuela, where police have arrested Daniel Barrera, who is one of Colombia's most wanted men, believed to be part of a gang responsible for smuggling 10 tons of cocaine every month to Mexican drug cartels. Well, in recent weeks, the Colombian authorities had been closing in on the man they call Crazy Barrera, arresting some 36 members of his gang and seizing 5 tons of the drug, as well as 21 aircraft. Well, the Colombian president, Juan Manuel Santos, has said on TV that Crazy Barrera was perhaps the most wanted kingpin in recent times. Well, joining us on the line now to discuss this is an expert in Colombian affairs, the author, journalist and documentary maker Tom Feiling. Thank you very much indeed and welcome to Midori House. Now, as drug kingpins go, how big a catch is this?
Well, yeah, I don't think they get much bigger than Daniel Barrera. He's a name that kept cropping up over the last 10 years as one of the biggest of Colombia's cocaine traffickers.
And then presumably he didn't operate on his own. He presumably had plenty of honchos and people working underneath him. Who else is out there?
Well, I mean, it's just amazing the extent of the corruption when cases like this come to trial and you find out how the empires were run. And certainly thinking about previous kingpins who've been brought to trial, you find that the web of corruption and the number of people who were bought out, I mean, there wasn't even... Sometimes, you know, they're also murderous. There are people who do resist and have to be taken out and killed. But by and large, they depend on corruption of, you know, all the municipal and state authorities. It can become quite embarrassing. I mean, who knows what will come out in Barrera's trial, but if precedents are anything to go by, it'll be interesting to see how he ran his empire.
And Tom, does that corruption go beyond a municipal level? Does it go all the way to the very top?
Well, I'm thinking about the arrest of a previous drug trafficker a couple of years ago, and certainly the Colombian Navy were involved. There were police officers, there were judges that had been bought. There were very few people who were bribe-proof, and when you look at how much money they're turning over, you can understand why.
Now, the fact that Daniel Barrera is now in custody, is that going to make any significant difference to the drug smuggling industry, if you can call it that?
Well, again, I mean, he is big. He's a really big catch, and I can understand why everyone's celebrating in the Colombian police force. And usually bringing down a big kingpin like this will have a momentary disruption to the business. There's quite often it's followed by a spike in violence as his lieutenants will be struggling for control of the business. You might see prices going up in the main markets that were benefiting from his smuggling, which, as I understand it, were firstly Venezuela, then Brazil. It sounds like he's supplying the Mexicans, so you might see a momentary spike. But this is the irony of it all. Ultimately, someone else will step into his shoes, and there's unlikely to be a long-running dip in cocaine prices.
So you're basically saying there are plenty of other drug kingpins out there, more or less of Crazy Barrera's magnitude, and if they're not already of that significance, they soon will be.
Well, yeah. I mean, this is the irony of it all, is that by putting this constant pressure on the drugs trafficking business, what you do is, well, you increase corruption, they necessitate violence, they turn to violence, and also you weed out those who are less ruthless or less effective. So what you're left with is the most vicious, most effective and brightest traffickers. So, you know, and that is, you know, a consequence of the law enforcement efforts being made to bring them in.
And are those efforts being driven from the very top? To what extent does the Colombian president, Santos, drive this, you know, crackdown on kingpins of this stature?
Well, I mean, it's certainly, he's, all of the Colombian political class is well aware of the huge damage and disruption that's been created by the cocaine business. Since the Americans fund a lot of the anti-drugs efforts, you can argue to what extent the Colombians are in charge. It is an international effort. And until recently, it's been one with a very much a military focus. But I think what Santos would like to see is, you know, going back to the original Plan Colombia back in 1999, which was supposed to be a social development plan to tackle the poverty that drives a lot of Colombian farmers into producing coca in the first place. So perhaps we're going to see, we're certainly going to see less money from the states, and that money now perhaps being diverted into alternative crop production. But a lot remains to be seen.
So the United States has a role in all of this, an important one, because they put up a bounty for Daniel Barrera, comparable to the bounty they had on the head of Osama bin Laden. But on the other hand, you know, is there a feeling amongst the authorities in Colombia and amongst the people of Colombia that, you know, if the demand could be, you know, brought under control to a greater extent and more could be done to stop consumption of drugs in the United States and in other major markets, perhaps there wouldn't be these turf wars in their backyard?
Well, no, they certainly wouldn't. If there weren't a demand for cocaine, there wouldn't be a supply of cocaine. And this is something that's constantly been raised by the presidents of producer countries or trafficking countries or countries in which production and trafficking passes, that until Europe and the States starts tackling the demand for cocaine, the best that they can do is shift the business from one part of Latin America to another. So what you've seen, a problem that was endemic in the Caribbean was shifted westwards into Mexico. A problem that, you know, was huge in Colombia, the coca cultivation increasingly now moving into Bolivia and Peru. But tackling demand in the West, I mean, these days they don't even try to tell Western consumers that this is a bloody trade. Western consumers seem indifferent to that. A few years ago, the Colombian government made a lot of noises about the environmental destruction caused by the cocaine business. But it's no one really looks at how you can reduce demand for cocaine, especially because in the States at least, a large part of the demand is from addicts. The casual users actually don't get through as much cocaine as the addicts do. And addicts, you know, that's one of the last things on their mind, I imagine. The fact that this is part of a very long and bloody supply chain.
And what was really striking about this operation to capture Crazy Barrera, as they call him, was the fact that he's a Colombian national. He was captured on Venezuelan territory with help from British and US intelligence services. A very unusual collaboration there, because we don't tend to think of the Brits, the Colombians and the Americans collaborating to a great extent on anything, really, with Venezuela.
I mean, but the Venezuelans have always been adamant that, you know, that they're as determined to tackle drugs trafficking as anyone else. I think that the Venezuelan case was that they didn't want to give the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, which is an American agency, as much scope as the DEA was accustomed to. But the Venezuelans have always been adamant that drug trafficking is, you know, a blight in Venezuela as it is anywhere else. And all the multiple agencies that were working this up, I mean, the British have been involved in counter-drugs operations and counter-insurgency operations in Colombia for a long time.
And very briefly, is Colombia a country that's changing? I mean, I hear more and more about people who are going there, visiting there. There's a lot of talk about people investing in Colombia. Is the country's reputation really changing?
Well, briefly, yes, it is. It's much safer than it used to be. I think you're more likely to be kidnapped in Trinidad these days than you are in Colombia. It's much safer. There's a lot more foreign investment. There's more tourists going to Colombia. I mean, you can't turn a blind eye to the problems that remain there. There is still a simmering civil war. And you still have the guerrillas under arms. They're about to go into peace talks in October. If those talks are successful, then Colombia will become safer still. But certainly there's been major changes in Colombia. There's no point denying that. But at the same time, it's still a question of wait and see.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much indeed, Tom Feiling, expert in Colombian affairs, author, journalist and documentary maker.
On the latest edition of Section D, we check out the pocket-sized craft trade fair in Tokyo for stockists. We find out who might be getting their hands on Usain Bolt's bed and what will happen to the rest of the furniture from the Olympic Village. And we visit a pioneering design studio in Ramallah, turning trash into treasure.
When it comes to trash that we know already is a huge problem, that's what we start out by designing, and then we finding the raw material has been the easiest part.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
The October issue of Monocle says hola to the world, as we look at how speaking Portuguese is becoming the rising language of trade, diplomacy, sport and culture. We travel through the Lusophone world, from Brazil to Angola, the Azores to Mozambique, to cover the people making their mark in everything from politics to soap operas.
In the design section, we visit the Porto studio of Álvaro Siza, and we soak up the autumn sun in a Spartan rural lakeside house in the heart of the Swedish countryside.
In the edit section, we take you to Coruche, a 30-minute drive from Lisbon where we harvest the best cork in the world for our specialist feature. We also hop on a plane to Amsterdam in search of tasty, organic and seasonal recipes at local favorite De Kaas restaurant.
The October issue of Monocle also includes our annual style survey that delivers you a head-to-toe vision of the trends to watch. It's all on newsstands now and also available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world, or, as they say in Portuguese,
Monocle, sempre de olho no mundo.
The basics of an urban dwelling are seemingly carved in stone. You've got bathrooms, bedrooms, living areas, kitchens, and so on. But with space running out and inner city square footage at a premium price, the serial entrepreneur Simon Woodruff thinks it's time to re-examine the fundamentals of city dwelling. That's with his new project, Yo Home, which is a modular and highly adaptable living system that's closer to stage scenery than bricks and mortar. Well, Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck stopped playing with his new puppy for long enough to travel to the 100% design show at London's Earl's Court to hear a little bit more.
Simon, we spoke to you earlier in the week for the Entrepreneurs Show, and it was great to hear about the ideas that were behind Yo Home, and now we see it in fruition. Could you just explain to us what the basic idea is behind Yo Home?
Well, you know, what I always do is start with a blank sheet of paper, and my blank sheet of paper was, what would a home be if it was called Yo? And I've used the sort of mechanics of stage scenery to build a, in this case, an 800 square foot home, that by moving walls, we have a false floor, a false ceiling, things go up and down, things come in and out. There's 12 what I call tricks. And really, it's incredible use of space. And it's a bit like having, this is the size of a one-bedroom apartment, it's a bit like having a four-bedroom apartment with three reception rooms, all for the price, for the land price, of a much smaller apartment.
Now, obviously, that argues goes along with the argument that you need kind of smaller apartments in cities and we need to use better use of our space. Is that part of the reasoning behind the project?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you can look at it lots of different ways, but I mean, people are going to want to live it. Some people are going to want to live in places like this, and the early adopters will be better off people. It'll start off more expensive. And as it goes on, this can absolutely be for teachers and doctors and really for anybody. Yeah, it'll come down in price as we go.
But just to be clear, the starting point is, you know, that I think many people, when they imagine kind of beds folding into walls, they have kind of Yeah, they think of comedy films from the 30s or something, but it's not like that, is it? It's kind of aiming at a much higher customer.
Yeah, it's that's kind of naff, isn't it? But look, I'll tell you what. Rowan Atkinson made a great movie, Johnny English, in which somebody got their tie caught in the conveyor belt at Yo Sushi, which is, of course, I founded. And I reckon Rowan Atkinson could have a great time in here.
And just tell me the last thing, the mechanics of this, does this mean that somebody needs to be quite technically aware? Do you think there's kind of risks that you're going to have lots of repairs ahead of you if you're not somebody who can work out the mechanics of how this whole apartment works?
Yeah. No, I mean, look, this is the first prototype, and believe it or not, we've even had some problems this morning with getting a few things to work. But we'll be into 3-4 prototypes before we open. Technology, you couldn't have done this 10 years ago. Technology is at a place where you absolutely can do things. And a lot of this works on counterweights, which is how theatre works, actually. So the weights you're moving, I can take the bed mechanism here, when the bed goes up into the ceiling, and I can take that and do it by hand and lift it with one hand. So it's fairly simple technology. And of course, we use technology as human beings in jets, in motor cars, in all sorts of places we go around the world. Why not at home?
And finally, when do you think we might see the first people moving into one of these apartments?
Well, we launched Yotel here 7 years ago, and within 18 months we had one open. I think it was 18 months, maybe 2 years, we had a first one open at Gatwick, and now, of course, we've got four hotels, the big one, 700 bedrooms in New York. And I think, 18 months, 2 years, you'll probably see a prototype of a dozen flats, but hopefully in the next few years after that, you'll start to see skyscrapers in New York or São Paulo in Japan. I'd love to take Yo home back to Japan. That would be great.
Interesting stuff. Well, joining us here in the studio is Andrew himself. Andrew, you've been to see that sort of home concept in action, a mock-up of it. What's it like?
I think it's quite clever, actually. So what the first thing is to move away from the idea that this is just about kind of cramming everything into a bed sit. It's not about kind of beds popping up into walls and miniature kind of ironing boards. It's really about how you use a space to its best advantage. Now, Woodroffe is interesting because he lives on a boat, and I think he lives on a very big boat, but he's used to the kind of the cabinetry and the way that people make boats and the way you can kind of tuck things away and hide things away. He's also a man who I think has probably been in a first class cabin once or twice, so he's seen that kind of technology, and he's used the best of that to think about, whether the furniture all needs to be out during the day. Now, he's already used some of these ideas when he helped set up Yo Hotel. So Yo Hotel, which is in New York, the beds do fold away during the day. So it gives you a bigger room during the day when you're in your hotel. And many of us who have stayed in tiny rooms in New York know that actually you're often kind of edging your way around the bed during the day. And he's found a way to kind of pop this in. I think he's used that love of technology, which has always been in his businesses, to kind of create something that's actually quite intriguing. And I think what's good is he's setting something up as a template, which I imagine that he'll want developers to come knocking on his door and say, actually, we could take this and use it in this way, or we could take this and build something in Tokyo that would work, or do you know what, in Sao Paulo we have a project this would work for. So I think at this point, he's just putting out a prototype and saying, look at this and imagine what you could do with it.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? Because you think about the format of a standard home. It hasn't really changed in a couple of centuries, really, when you think of the model. But did you get the impression when you were looking at what he's set up that you went to have a look at today that he's placed too much emphasis on the practicality and not enough on the comfort? Or did it look sort of all quite comfortable at the same time?
Well, I don't want to be too harsh on anyone who's setting up something for the first time. And I understand that they were there, the key team were there for overnight for the last 2 or 3 days. And they've pulled it together. They've brought the mechanics up from the countryside where it was being built. And it looks good. But, it's not really about the dressing at this point. It's really about getting people to understand what their ambition is about how you use space. And the other interesting thing, I think, is that on The Urbanist, we're often meeting developers who are talking about how you make our urban centres more dense. And that's a real issue for every city. They want to get more people living in the centre. And his idea is, well, actually, with the same footprint of a single small apartment, he's using 800 square feet He's saying, well, actually, you can fit in almost as much as you'd get into a 2 or 3 bedroom apartment in sense of facilities, but you just use them better. There's another, so there's quirky things. There's a shower in which if you take away the thing that you would stand on, it will fill a kind of a kind of Japanese style wooden tub below. So you can have a little miniature bath as well. But they take exactly the same column of space as you'd for both things, whereas in most apartments people would give you a space for a bath and a space for an apartment, for a shower, and that, you know, that obviously that starts eating up your floor space.
The whole thing is conjuring up all sorts of images in my head of Japan, and I'm thinking of capsule hotels, and I'm thinking of the bathroom, which is one plastic molded unit where you sort of swing the tap around and it fills the bath, and you swing it back around and it fills the basin. Did it have a sort of slightly Japanese influence to it?
He has, yeah. He's been influenced by Japan throughout his career. So people who are not in the UK, Simon Woodroth made his name here and elsewhere by, first of all, bringing in the conveyor belt sushi restaurant to Europe. And he was the first person, I believe, to do that. And he was very successful here from day one. And then he used the same kind of idea of the capsule hotel. He opened those at airports here in the UK. And then that's gone on to be developed and grown into a fully fledged hotel brand. And I think, yeah, he's looked at... It's amazing when you look through Japanese magazines at all the ideas they have for using space, and using space in a way that doesn't feel bed-city, but feels, you know, elegant and just, again, making the use of small footprint apartments in Tokyo. And I think, yeah, he's been inspired by that. It doesn't have a Japanese aesthetic. He's not asking you to sleep in a futon. But he is kind of using some of those ideas about compactness and compelling design to change the way that you use your apartment.
Well, I hope he comes to Paris sometime and sorts out some of our very odd dwelling places in Paris. Some minuscule flats in the middle of Paris could definitely do with a more intelligent use of space. And it sounds like he's the man to provide it. Thank you very much indeed, Monocle's editor, Andrew Tuck. Well, in the next half hour of the programme, I'll be sitting down with Martin Roth, who's the director of London's Victoria and Albert Museum, for insight into the London Design Festival. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the headlines.
Thank you very much. The Arab League Secretary General has said today that both the League and the United Nations Security Council were incapable of solving the crisis in Syria. Nabil El Arabi said the League and the international community had shamefully failed Syrians. South African police have fired tear gas to disperse protesters near a mine run by top platinum producer Anglo American today. The first sign of unrest spreading after strikers at the smaller rival Lonmin won big pay rises within hours of Lonmin agreeing to pay increases of up to 22%. Workers at neighbouring mines were calling for similar hikes. As widespread protests against a defamatory video of the Prophet Muhammad continued across Pakistan, its government has today announced that on Friday, the majority Muslim country will observe a day of reverence for the Prophet. The short film, produced in California and posted online, has sparked days of violent protests all over the world, with American and European embassies attacked in at least 20 countries. And the Burmese democracy activist Aung San Suu Kyi has today met with US Senate leaders on Capitol Hill in Washington. Suu Kyi, who won the 1991 Nobel Peace Prize, will meet privately with President Barack Obama later this evening. And those are the stories for the moment on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan. You're listening to Midori House. It's coming up to 33 minutes past 6 in the evening here in London. Don't go away, because in just a moment I'll be speaking to Martin Roth, who is the director of the Victoria and Albert Museum here in London.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
Essa är Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 taget, ja.
This is Monocle 24. 24.
24. This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 è Yorkshire.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The proper Jalavet. Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
After I met Monocle 24.
The hat at Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24. You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24.
24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24. 24 You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24. We're coming to you live from London. Now, with the 10th London Design Festival well underway, each day on Midori House, we've been talking to a different character at the heart of the event. Well, today it's the turn of Martin Roth, who's the director of the Victoria and Albert Museum, the festival's partner institution. Well, for the 10th anniversary of the festival, the V&A has a number of installations and is holding a number of events. Well, Martin, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Tell us a little bit about what's been happening.
I mean, like always, every year, it's really exciting for us. It's not only the installation of the designers, it's also the, let's say, the normal public coming in, being surprised at what they are seeing there. And this year we have really something that's completely special, never been there before. It's in the cupola of the building. It's a prism done by Keiichi Matsuda, and you see the area around it, and you see also the museum inside from the top of the building. So that's one part of it. The garden has beautiful bench installations, and so on and so on. It's worth coming to the museum. And we have this digital design weekend for children Saturday and Sunday. So there are a lot of opportunities to come.
So very much something that the whole family could go to.
It's both. And I mean, it's the whole area. I just come back from a few minutes ago from the Brompton Quarter. If you see what they are doing in those shops around there and in those apartments and so on, it's really great. The whole area is design.
Now, do you curate the events and exhibitions around a sort of central theme? And if so, what is it?
No, I mean, we try to bring it somehow together to the collection or combine it with the collection. But it's not a special theme in that case. It's the museum in itself that has this relation to the objects, but it's not a theme that we want to have.
Now, the design festival, is it purely a creative showcase, or does it have a commercial value for Britain's designers and indeed for the entire design industry?
You know, I mean, I talked to John Sorrell a few days ago, and what he started together with Ben Evans is honestly unique. I mean, you know that they've been copied, I think, 18, 19 times in different cities. And I think it's extremely important for politicians, for universities, academies, education, to see that it's not about either the art or economy, that it's both, that's really connected. And that what happened in London at that time of the year is really part of the business. It's about manufacturing, it's about engineering, but at the same time, it's about design and the art. So it's a combination of both of it.
And it very much helps, doesn't it, to put London on the map.
I mean, London is on the map. I don't think that we...
Keeps need London to, on the map.
But it's, after the Olympic Games and all those high times and climax, it's the right moment to start with something new and go on with it for the...
Absolutely. London has seems to... Every time I come here, I'm based in Paris. Every time I come, there seems to be some amazing event.
How can you be based in Paris when London is so amazing?
Well, it's actually a short train journey away, so it's not all that far away. It's a bit like living in another city of the UK.
Suburban.
It's so easy. But the V&A's original mandate was to showcase and enlighten the British public about the power of design. That's what it was originally set up for. Correct me if I'm wrong. Is that still the case?
Sure. I mean, more than ever. Really, more than ever. I mean, we said it already, and I think, again, we have to do more in this case in the future. It's about the creativity. It's about, I mean, creating new things, but at the same time, it's about engineering and manufacturing and learning skills and being somehow in a tradition. I think that's the important part for the future. It's not only the idea of the design. It's when the production come in, then quality and mass production is one of the topics for the next years. So there wasn't so much change in the last 150 years. So the V&A is more than ever an important institution to showcase design and the way to do it. We called it a year ago in an exhibition, we called it the power of making. And I think that's the right formula for the future.
And will there be a competition with the new, rather improved design museum, which is going to be opening down the road at the Commonwealth Building?
There's no competition. I can't say that I'm a bit tired of that discussion, but it's like everyone's watching us as, where is this competition? I think even some of the team of the design museum think that is just waiting for more discussions around it. No, there's enough space for all of us. There's enough intellectual space. And if you think about topics for the future and education for the future and whatever it is, it's better to I mean, to find a joint program, it's a kind of a mutual understanding what we are doing, and it's not a competition at all.
There's room for everyone.
I mean, there's more than room for everyone, honestly. I mean, in the poor sense of it, but also in an intellectual and philosophical way. And as you said before, it's also business. It's both. I mean, being related to the business in Britain, it's important for both museums, and I think that's also a possibility to work together.
Of course, the V&A carries with it a brand which is known probably everywhere in the world.
I mean, absolutely, it's difficult for me to talk about it, but it's because it's being a bit arrogant away, but definitely true wherever you go. The V&A is very well known, and at the same time, it's the legacy of 1851, that important exhibition in London, combined with the Royal College of Art, all the academic institutions that are founded in that area. So it's showcasing the future, showcasing creativity, and that's a great opportunity for both of those museums.
And what do you think, going back to the London Design Festival, is the relevance of that festival today?
I mean, the relevance is that there's a lot of young talents out there. There are a lot of young creativity and a lot of people that look for showcases. And then normally they don't have the chance to work in a museum, to work with a museum, or to show what they are doing. And if you walk around in South Kensington right now and in other places where they showcase design, there's a lot of emerging talents coming in. I mean, we gave the medal a few days ago for emerging talents to Daisy Ginsberg. I don't know if I've seen her production. It's unbelievable. I mean, honestly, it's worth to see it if your intellectual capacity can deal with it. It's about, honestly, it's about translating complex scientific systems in design. I mean, it's in between design and arts and philosophy, but that's one strength. And then you see just design for, having seen that half an hour ago from Africa, done in a way that it's really for the profit of a society that is in need and has a lot of problems. So, you know, it's the whole variety of design that is showcased in London in those days. And it's, as I said before, it's from the business. I mean, there's a B&B talk tomorrow night, to an exhibition, to parties, whatever it is. It's the variety.
And finally, is there anywhere else in the world that's comparable
right, exactly.
to
that
London?
That was my summary right now. That's the
there is nowhere
there's,
else.
There is no one else. It's here. And as I said before,
what would
there,
be
there
what
are
would
some
be your
copies.
Second place? Let's talk about a second runner-up.
Another city?
Yeah.
Maybe it's in Korea, and I mean definitely China. Starting right now, we work with a museum in Shenzhen, or a museum that will be built in the future in Shenzhen. There's a lot of appetite and hunger and amazing expertise already. No, but I think it's probably Asia, and it's here.
None of the European capitals?
I mean, it's easy to say Italy, because, I mean, Milan is always the city that is connected to design, but it's a different way, a different style, and maybe closer to business. This kind of avant-garde, this kind of cutting edge, that's here in London, and that's what we like.
All right. We're going to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed to Martin Roth, the director
of the V&A.
Thank
you, and come to the museum whenever you want to
come. I certainly will.
Perfect.
I'm inspired to be. I haven't been there for years, in fact. Every time I go past...
Oh, may I add something? I just saw something that's really amazing.
Oh.
On the Brompton Quarter, it's called Field Guide. It comes from Dundee, and I haven't seen something like this before, but maybe I was just naive. It's a newspaper that is connected to the internet. Maybe that's...
No? That sounds rather interesting.
Maybe it's something from Monaco.
Can you
honestly
pass it to
see
me?
It? Yeah.
Can I have a flick through?
Yeah, take it. It's worth to see it, honestly.
I will flick through this right after this short break, which we're about to have, because tomorrow, just so you know, we'll be joined by Ben Evans, who is the director of the London Design Festival. So listen out for that tomorrow. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
A bit like a documentary film, but without any pictures.
There are some actors, there are quite a lot of musicians.
Festival.
Galleries. There's...
You are cordially invited to tune in to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. The show that wants to tell you about the music, art, books, films and media we think you should know about wherever in the damn world you've pitched your tent.
Some people collect shoes and other people collect Ferraris. I collect art.
On the latest edition, we go to Zurich's International Radio Festival. We meet up with Damon Albarn's Africa Express, and we have a lovely session and chat with ex-charlatan Tim Burgess.
Music tastes are very varied, and I think if I can listen to them, then everyone else must be able to have that kind of broad sense of music as well. Yeah.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Marching in step with our defence-themed issue, Monocle Films reported to duty at Seer Precision, designing groundbreaking camouflage to Cooper Hewitt grads show how form and function can save lives.
We get a lot of people saying that they attribute their safety and sometimes their survival to multicam, specifically saying that in some instances we were caught in the open, we had no cover, we could see the enemy, we thought for sure they could see us, and somehow they didn't, and we were able to survive that engagement.
The Art of Getting Lost, a monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Burgess-Watson. Now, the Pre-Italia Awards and Festival are currently taking place this week, in fact, in Turin. It's now in its 64th year. The festival, which is hosted by the state broadcaster RAI, is celebrating the best in high-end radio, television and online work from 115 broadcasters in 48 different countries. Well, Monocle's producer Katie Bilboa is in Turin to report on the event for next week's Culture Show, and she joins us now on the line. Hi there, Katie. Tell us a little bit about what's been going on there in Turin, and hopefully tell us as well that you've had some sunshine.
I have, Tom. I'm happy to report. The sun has been shining here. I'm not sure what the weather's like in London, but it's been gloriously Italian in Turin. I feel like it's a city that maybe doesn't quite have the smart business ethic of Milan. It maybe isn't quite as beautiful as Rome, but it's definitely charming in its own right. The Pre-Italia Festival is taking place. It's on a street called Via Verdi, which is kind of in the northern part of the city. It's spread across a few different RAI venues, which mainly are around that street and the areas surrounding it. And they have literally put the red carpet on the pavement. I'm not saying it's particularly long red carpet, but it's definitely there. And there are kind of big signs hanging from buildings and signs out on the pavement. So there's definitely a sense that there's something happening. And alongside the awards, there's quite a lot of cultural events taking place in the city, and I think it's considered quite a big cultural event here. But having said that, you know, it's definitely very Italian, and without wanting to kind of resort to any national stereotypes, there are a lot of sort of older men hanging around in suits. It's not always clear what's going on all the time, and there's lots of it taking place in Italian as well, so that's partly my own fault for not being able to understand everything that's going on, but I think that's kind of part of its charm. And you know, if you try and contrast it something to like the Cannes Lion Advertising Festival, which is a huge kind of corporate event, this is a lot more understated, it's a lot more sort of classy, I guess, and a lot more Italian.
Mm. Well, perhaps you're going to come back with and sign on immediately for evening classes in Italian. But Katie, tell us how it all works. Talk us through the different elements of that festival.
Okay, so the main kind of beating heart of the event is the awards, which take place on Friday evening in the city here. And the member broadcasters enter their programmes in either radio, television and online. And each of those categories has its own subcategories for which each has an award or two for different under different headings. They tend to be traditional formats. So you're looking at radio music programming, which tends to be more classical music. There's drama and documentaries. It's really kind of the high end of broadcasting and of speech and music production. They're slowly trying to evolve this. I think they're trying to involve online stations, you know, and things like that. But generally, it's quite traditional high end radio. And then on the other half of it is that you've got these events in and around the city, which kind of surround the awards. So yesterday there was an event about promoting co-productions between Turkey and Italy. today and tomorrow there's an event which kind of can stand alone on its own, which is about a radio convention where they're talking about multimedia in radio. There's an art exhibition going on in the city, a video portraits exhibition by Robert Wilson. So there's quite a lot of things going on. You can go and watch all the entrants different, and you can listen to some of the nominees for the awards in a building nearby the Rye Studios. There's cinema screenings, there's all sorts of things going on in and around the festival, but really the awards are kind of the central event.
Okay, and in the context of the broadcasting calendar, how significant event is the Pre-Italia?
Well, they bill themselves as the Nobel Prize of the broadcasting world. And one person said to me, winning a Pre-Italia is akin to winning an Oscar. And I think that's how they like to think of themselves. As I said before, it's this kind of high-end, creative radio production. But I should say now that although they've expanded since the original creation by the British, French and Italian public broadcasters, they've expanded now to include 115 broadcasters, as you said earlier, from 48 different nations. But it is still dominated by public broadcasters. So in certain circles, I think this is considered a huge accolade, but you're not going to find the likes of, your Sky and your CNN and people like that here. But despite that, it's quite unique, and it really is a platform for the kind of the best of the best. A lot of the jurors who come from the member broadcasters say, this is an opportunity also for them to kind of meet up and learn from each other and to continue to kind of hone their craft.
Mm. You mentioned there the UK, Italy and France as, founding countries in broadcast. Do they still seem to be sort of dominating there at that festival?
Well, it's kind of a mixture. I mean, if you look at the winners from last year, it is still the European nations who are dominating, not just UK, Italy and France. You've got Finland, Norway, Sweden, all winning awards last year, and then CBC got one award last year. But yesterday I met Giovanni Mellella, who's the Pre-Italia Secretary General, and I asked her which nations were now the most competitive, and this is what she told me.
Beh, i nuovi grandi, diciamo, competitori al Pre-Italia.
There are many new great competitors to the Pre-Italia countries and subscribers, and which are the events hosted in other continents. And we're thinking about Japan or Canada or Korea. Korea is very focused on culture and culture making. And of course, this includes the television and radio field. But I'm thinking also about China and India. So competition is harsh, and there are many competitors, but it's good because we are talking about top level competition amongst broadcasters like BBC, Rai, but also German television, France television, Holland and Norway. So it's all of this is very important, and we can say that the Pre-Italia is like the Nobel Prize for this.
Il premio Nobel della radio e della televisione.
All right, so that was the Pre-Italia Secretary General speaking to you, Katie, just a little earlier on. Now, how does the judging work?
Well, the judges, they're made up of representatives from all the major broadcasters. They're generally experienced producers that come along to form part of the judging committee. There's about 12 for each prize. And I think it's quite a difficult job because if you think about it, the television, everybody, they have subtitles, so they can try to understand things. But the radio is even more difficult because you can't have subtitles or dubbing for a radio program. So a lot of these programs, they've just got an English transcript. Some of those transcripts aren't that thorough. So I think it's quite a difficult task trying to compare works from different cultures that come from different, editorial kind of standards and with different production standards. But that's kind of how they do it.
And Katie, is this all about celebrating creativity, or do you think there's a little bit of a business element to this whole event?
I think that definitely the primary focus is creativity, but business is starting to creep in a bit too. I actually put this question to Don Serafini, who's editor of the trade publication Video Trade International, and this is what he told me.
Many years ago, there was some sort of business going on during Pre-Italia. Then it turned to be a festival purely on artistic element without the business element. So people did not really come here to look for product. They came over here to be recognized. So they didn't have any after market, after life, this particular festival. Now, thanks to Rye World, that they want to bring a commercial element, the festival may have an afterlife, the sense that the producer can come here, the screen shows and say, oh, this is really good for my territory, or this is good for some other territories that I'm familiar with.
All right, that was Dom Serafini speaking to you a little earlier on, Katie. And finally, do you think Monocle might be in there next year?
Well, they've actually invited us to nominate ourselves. I think the main problem for us is that actually we don't make really programmes that fit into their categories. But interestingly, they did have a meeting earlier to discuss whether they should, you know, be evolving further. So I think they're quite conscious of wanting to stay with the times. But just going back to that clip there, I think it's really interesting, you know, that this isn't really being used as much of a platform for business. I think, you know, here are the best producers in the world looking for the best content in the world that appeals kind of universally. So I think, you know, looking forward for them, of course, yes, Monocle should be included. But it also strikes me as an excellent opportunity to do a bit of business as well. So hopefully in the future there'll be more of that.
All right. So thank you very much indeed, Monocle producer Katie Bilboa there in Turin. You're listening to Midori House. It is precisely 5 to 7 in the evening here in London. You're listening to Midori House. Now, this week, the film world has turned its gaze towards the Alps, where the 8th Zurich Film Festival is getting started, as well as attracting tens of thousands of visitors, journalists, and well-known actors and actresses from across the globe. The event also draws promising filmmakers in droves, all of them hoping to leave with the coveted Golden Eye Award. Well, to tell us more, we're joined by Carl Spoeri, who is the festival's artistic director. Good evening to you, Carl. Thank you very much indeed for talking to us. There are lots of film festivals around the world taking place every single year. Zurich's unique, isn't it? Tell us why.
Well, I think it's really a perfect city to host a festival. As a perfect infrastructure, we are in the middle of Europe. It's very easy accessible. And it's a small city, but it doesn't feel really small, so you don't have to miss a lot of things. And people like to come here, and I think we'll have a great program.
Certainly sounds like a great lineup. Looking at it, and lots of things happening on the sidelines. It's not just films, is it?
No, of course. I mean, it's on one hand, of course, the film are the most important thing, and then we have all the honorees that are coming to Zurich, and then we have special things like, for example, the Film Finance Forum. Which takes place Saturday, September 22nd, which is a conference about financing films. And this is something which we are doing for the first time now and has established very good, because obviously Zurich is a good place to looking for fundings and to reach out for investors and banks. And so this is a platform, and a lot of U.S. people are coming, a lot of people from the UK, from France are coming to Zurich, and I think this will be a very interesting thing.
So as well as attracting filmmakers, investors, you're also attracting a number of stars this year. Who are you expecting?
Well, tomorrow we open the festival with Savages, and John Travolta will be here in Zurich, and we'll have Helen Hunt will come in on Friday. Then we have Richard Gere and Susan Sarandon coming on Sunday for their film Arbitrage. A couple more, but these are the most prominent.
Oh, some big names there. And it's presumably important, isn't it, to have people of that stature and that sort of profile to give the event that little bit of extra star quality.
Yes, of course. That's always important, especially for us, because we are funded mostly by private sponsors and not by the government, which is unusual in Switzerland. And so most festivals here are funded by the government, but we are not. So for us, it's always important to get a lot of media attention. Of course, how do you get that? Obviously, with big names, and that's the reason it's important for us to, you know, grow and finance the festival. but it's also important, yeah, for the sponsors, obviously.
Thank you very much. I'm going to have to leave it there. Carl Spoeri, the director, the artistic director, rather, of the Zurich Film Festival. Thanks to our producer, Paul Noble, our researcher, A.K. Berakopi, and our studio manager, Chris Fitch. Well, up next is the news, and then it's our weekly business briefing, The Entrepreneurs. We're going to be meeting Will Thorndike, who's the author of a new book called The Outsiders, chronicling eight business leaders who don't fit the flashy, charismatic CEO stereotype, but are getting better results. Do stay tuned.